Welcome to the documentary from the BBC World Service, where we report the world, however difficult the issue, however hard to reach. Podcasts from the BBC World Service are supported by advertising.
If you're hearing this, you're probably already listening to in-depth stories on BBC Podcasts. But did you know that you can listen to them without ads? Get award-winning storytelling from the BBC, like World of Secrets, Believe in Magic and Uncanny, plus other great BBC podcasts from news to history to comedy, all ad-free. Simply subscribe to BBC Podcast Premium on Apple Podcasts or listen to Amazon Music with a Prime membership. Spend less time on ads and more time with BBC Podcasts.
Welcome to the documentary from the BBC World Service. Please note, this episode contains some outdated racial language that could cause offence. This week, on assignment in the United States.
I didn't know she was black until a number of years ago when she happened to turn black.
Former President Donald Trump speaking about Kamala Harris, the first black and Asian American vice president, whose parents are from India and Jamaica.
Because she was Indian all the way, and then all of a sudden she made a turn and she became a black person.
Just to be clear, sir, do you believe...
Predictably, these comments hit a nerve in the American psyche.
What he just said, what you just read out to me, is repulsive. It's insulting.
The White House press secretary, Karine Jean-Pierre, a black woman herself, said that only Vice President Harris can speak to her identity.
No one has any right to tell someone who they are, how they identify. That is not one's right.
Comments like these are always cutting and antagonistic around the world and in the US. They poke at scar tissue at the heart of this country. Ethnicity and authenticity. Power and privilege. Who are you really? Almost a decade ago, this challenge was put to a white woman who for years said she was black, and the world eagerly chronicled her fall from grace.
You didn't say, I identify as right. black. You'd say, I'm black. When did you start deceiving people?
Well, I do take exception to that because it's a little more complex.
Are you ashamed of being white?
Well, I do not fully understand what it means to be colored in this country.
Well, she does.
Rachel Dolezal, born to a white family, was able to pass as African-American, building her career around her black identity and heading up her local civil rights organisation. She was called a race faker, but today she still maintains that she is black. America's relationship with race has always been about power and its imbalances. Now, there's a sense that people with racial privilege are cashing in on something that doesn't belong to them. I'm Ellie House, and for assignment, I've travelled around the US to meet those at the centre of this ongoing identity storm, to ask, when it comes to race and ethnicity, who are you, and who gets to decide?
People report, and they're like whistleblowers, so they'll call us up or send us an email and say, hey, I think this person is a fraud.
This person is a fraud. Liana Costantino uses this phrase a lot. She's on the front lines of perhaps America's biggest identity battle. Who is a real Native American?
It's a simple question. You know, it's not rocket science. Are you Indian or not?
A short woman with a grey ponytail, Liana's a founding member of TAF, the Tribal Alliance Against Frauds. It's kind of a self-declared identity police, hunting down and exposing what she calls pretendians, or pretend American Indians.
The reason I'm suddenly part of this movement is because I got sick and tired of seeing it everywhere. And it's just disgusting.
The Native American population has ballooned by 85% in the past decade. Or at least, that's what the 2020 census, which allows you to self-identify your race, suggested. There are lots of reasons for this jump, none of which include an indigenous baby boom. Liana believes that many of these self-reporters are pretendians.
American Indian people today are the descendants of the few who managed to survive the original genocide. And we still only make up 1, maybe 2% of the population. Oftentimes we're just invisible, as it is. So to have all these wannabes and pretendians trying to replace us with their false narratives, false history, that's harm.
So it's existential to you?
Yeah, absolutely.
Why would people pretend? To some, maybe there's a cultural cachet that Native American identity brings. But there can also be financial benefits. Some Indian nations distribute casino revenue to their citizens, fund scholarships, or get discounts on things like fuel from tribal-owned vendors. From her sleuthing, Liana's compiled a list of pretendian warning signs.
These are common red flag pretendian phrases. I'm not a tribal member because my ancestors hid to avoid being documented. 99.9% of the time, that's nonsense. They use family pictures to prove that they're Indians. Just look at this picture of my grandma and you can clearly see she was an Indian. We don't do that.
American Indian identity is about ethnicity, but it's also about citizenship. Are you a legal member of a federally recognized tribe or nation? There are 574 of them in the US today, and each nation grants citizenship differently. Some base it on lineage. Can you prove that a direct relative was part of the tribe? Others look at the proportion of your ancestry. Some tribes require you to take classes or even pass a test on the culture and traditions of that tribe. Liana, through her mum, is a citizen of the Cherokee Nation of Oklahoma. Her dad is Italian.
We say, would you share with us what it is you're basing your claim of being Indian on? Then we investigate and we do their genealogy and we expose all the frauds. And if they want to come back and say, no, I'm really Indian, let me show you, and they can prove something to us, we would apologize and take it down.
Does that ever happen?
But no, it's not ever happened so far.
And how does it feel when you expose someone? What does it feel like?
Frustrating. Because 9 times out of 10, people don't care.
And the people that do care often disagree with Liana's tactics. She says she gets hundreds of death threats, mostly from people she's accused of faking. But even some other Native Americans don't support her. And TAF isn't officially endorsed by any tribe.
There have been many times when I have thought I quit. And it's because of the pain of being kicked to the curb by my fellow Cherokees. They don't seem to grasp the harm. They think that we're just being mean, and we get that a lot. Why are you so hateful? Why are you so mean? I am frustrated as hell.
Some of the statements made online, I've seen some people call them trolling. There's one post with a backdrop of poop emojis, and it says, Erica T. Worth, still a lying, thieving, pretendian fraud. Some people might see that's taking this too far. What do you say to those people?
I say that if they don't like somebody being called a lying, thieving, pretendian fraud, that person should stop being a lying, thieving, pretendian fraud.
Erica Worth, the target of these poop emojis, is a fiction writer who says that she has ancestry from 3 indigenous tribes, though she's not a tribal citizen. TAF has accused her of lying.
You know, if you're thieving from American Indian people by pretending to be one of us, knock it off.
Erica Worth denies the allegations made against her by the Tribal Alliance Against Frauds. She says that Native identity is a lot more complicated. So I'm on my way to Denver in Colorado to meet her.
Welcome to the Mile High City of Denver, where the local time is 9:49 in the evening. Please take up, please see.
Out in the suburbs, I'm greeted by Erica and her 2 very fluffy white dogs.
Hi, Erica.
Yes, Ellie, please come.
How
are
you doing?
Erica's debut novel, White Horse, is a ghost tale featuring an indigenous protagonist and touching on native stories. The pretendian allegations started shortly after its publication.
It was awful. I mean, there's just no way around it. I am of Native American descent, and I think it's madness in a country that has experienced genocide and slavery to pretend that indigenous identity can be like stuck into 2 neat categories. Real Indian, not real Indian.
They would say that you're not a citizen of a tribe, right, but you're profiting from tribe stories in your writing. Right. What do you say to that?
So I'm a writer who just takes everything that I come from and then combines it in a poetic and imaginative way. I think I'm no different from any other writer in that way.
On social media, the arena in which pretendian hunters and the alleged fraudsters battle this out, Erica dismissed TAF as 4 trolls in a trench coat and said that the genealogy they mapped out for her was wrong. She posted family photos, like this one of her grandmother.
She was somebody who could not pass as anything but Native American.
So as you can see, she's probably not even 1 year old, and that is her braid, and that is her little silver bracelet, and she was born in 1913, and when, if you were not Native, you don't have those things.
As we've heard, family photos are one of Taft's pretendian red flags. For Erica, though, they show that her claims didn't come out of nowhere.
And my mom was clearly not white. I mean, there's just no way around that. She was brown-skinned and had very Native features.
So they were both perceived by other people.
Right.
Including by Native people as well, as being Native.
Yeah, even for me, if I go on a rez, if I go to a powwow, there's never a question. It's more like, what tribe are you?
Erica says she's even faced racial harassment for being Native American. But she can't prove her Indigenous identity or qualify for tribal citizenship, she says, because of the quirks of history, not fraud.
My dad was a white dude. He's from Staten Island. My mom's family, though, some of them were Chickasaw and Black. Some of them were British and Cherokee. My family moved into Texas. They combined then with my other side of my family, who are Apaches from Mexico. So there's a tremendous amount of complication and movement, not just in my family, but in, you know, urban Indian spaces, like in general.
There was a lot of displacement of Indigenous people in the 19th and 20th centuries, much of it forced, much of it deadly, as American settlers pushed west. Native Americans lost their land, communities were pushed onto reservations, later policies of forced assimilation sought to absorb Indians into mainstream American culture. That's what Erica means when she says she's an urban Indian. Her family didn't live on tribal land. This was the case for around half the American Indian population by the 1980s.
The policy by census takers in the United States for a long period of time was such that if you were an urban Native and you were not on the reservation, the census takers were like, put them down as white or black. Otherwise, it will not encourage assimilation, and that's what we want. So this is why a lot of people do not end up with documentation.
This is all true. There are countless stories of people and groups who didn't make it onto official rolls. On the other hand, pretendian hunters would say that's too easy an excuse. Where's the proof? And to them, Erica is brandishing her connection just to sell books.
On your Twitter bio, you say Apache/Chickasaw/Cherokee. Why do you single out that part of your ethnic identity? If your dad's white, you've got other ethnicities in your mum's background. Why is that the bit that you mention?
As a person who speaks English, those are not parts of my background I have to struggle to express. Whereas being Native, you have to make a concerted effort to decolonize. So for me, it's important to put that out there as like, hey, we exist, and my work pulls from that part of me too.
I'm not here to act as the arbiter of American Indian identity. If anyone has that right, it's the tribes in question. But when I called all the nations mentioned in this program, they were reluctant to speak about the issue at all. They just didn't want to get into it. It's one thing to police ethnicity from within a group. Insiders, many of whom are mixed race in one way or another, hashing out the contours of their identity. But it's another thing to challenge yourself. What happens if you want to change race entirely? I've come to Cincinnati, a city in the bottom corner of Ohio, and I'm here to meet Ronnie Gladden.
So my skin is pretty brown in terms of complexion. My hair is thick. It's got twists and waves.
And how do you identify?
So the term transracial, I've used that.
Transracial.
Transracial. So a lot of people have heard of transgender, and some have heard of transracial. I have combined those two terms.
So that means that you were born, your body, as a black male.
Black and male,
black
yes.
and male, and you identify as
white and female in my aspirations, but black and male in my complications.
This is a pretty radical approach to identity. But Ronnie, who uses they-them pronouns, is not alone. On Reddit, there's an online community of some 2,000 people from around the world claiming to be transracial. And last year, the TikTok trend, RCTA, or Race Change to Another, generated responses that ranged from ridicule to offence. A lot of it is about appearance, with people in these corners of the internet sharing tips about how to change their body to match their desired race. But Ronnie had started taking these steps years before they became fringe internet trends.
So at 19, I had my first nose job. And before that, I had not just a black nose, but a black nose that was in excess. Like it was wider than probably typical. And I did some work on the lips just to balance that out. I've got on a little bit of foundation. With lights, it can make it very light, the complexion.
So that's a Maybelline...
Yeah, 245.
Classic beige colour.
Uh-huh.
Ronnie is a professor, a public speaker. They've written a book about this, called White Girl Within. They've been in therapy for the best part of 20 years. They wanted to make it clear to me that this is something they've thought about a lot. Transitioning from the inside out.
I remember being in preschool and being outside in the playground and wanting to animate in the same way that I saw my classmates, in the way that like your hair would respond to the wind and would flap around. I wanted to have the rosy cheeks, and I felt like that level of expression, that's what hits here, right in the center of my gut. Like that feels like home.
People might hear this and think, well, you were a very young child.
Right.
If you were surrounded by white kids, it makes sense that you would feel like that's how you should look. Because especially as you don't have the language of race at that time.
Exactly.
That doesn't necessarily mean that you are white.
Racial dissonance isn't that uncommon. It's usually a lot of kids that are of color that can experience similar things that I did, and they won't necessarily feel comfortable with their race. But almost overwhelmingly, it goes away. And that hasn't happened with me.
Ronnie says that they also experienced violence growing up and came to believe that perhaps this would have been different had they been a white girl.
I thought that there was a power of beauty, a power of skin. So if there's anyone that would have gotten the message, you know, back the hell off, it would have been with that kind of authority that would be embodied within white femaleness.
What does whiteness mean to you?
A part of it is an aesthetic. Another part of it is there's this whole notion of, oh, don't lose your black card. There's only one kind of cultural scripting that goes along with blackness, and you can't depart from that. And that feels too shackling. Whiteness, I see more of a liberation.
Ronnie's inner struggle is the opposite to the fight going on in Native American circles. It's individual, private, and has nothing at all to do with ancestry. But it's part of the broad reckoning on ethnicity and authenticity taking place across the US today.
This is not self-hatred, at least it's not for me. I cannot change that I was born black and male, that is true. But your own psychology and your identity, I would say that absolutely, it can transcend race.
You're listening to the documentary from the BBC World Service.
If you're hearing this, you're probably already listening to in-depth stories on BBC Podcasts. But did you know that you can listen to them without ads? Get award-winning storytelling from the BBC, like World of Secrets, Believe in Magic and Uncanny, plus other great BBC podcasts from news to history to comedy, all ad-free. Simply subscribe to BBC Podcast Premium on Apple Podcasts or listen to Amazon Music with a Prime membership. Spend less time on ads and more time with BBC Podcasts.
Welcome back to the documentary. I'm Ellie House. There's a general consensus now that race is a social construct. There's nothing innate or biological underpinning racial differences. That's what's really informed Ronnie's view.
race isn't real. Except it is socially. It impacts the way people are seen and treated and the way they see themselves. So far, I've spoken to individuals fighting to claim what they believe is their true ethnicity, as well as those challenging the identity of others. But in the US, sometimes whole communities have had their racial identity imposed upon them by their neighbours and even the state. About a two-hour drive east of Cincinnati is the rural Ohio town of East Jackson. It's so small that it's not on a map. So I'm meeting local resident Karen Harris Jackson at nearby Waverly to show me around.
You got contact.
Hi, Karen.
You want to get in? Okay, I am Karen Jackson. I'm white, but I'm black. Well, that's it.
Do you want to describe what you look like?
Okay, I am 5'6". I am light complected. I have straight hair. I have brown eyes. But I am... my nationality is American Afro.
If you were to bump into Karen on the street, chances are you wouldn't think she was a black woman. But on her birth certificate...
Yeah, what does it
but
say?
But it says Negro. It says Negro. And most people look like me mm-hmm. from our area. So I'm going to show you the minority part of Pike County.
I look forward
to it.
Are
we off? Ready?
Yeah, let's go.
Okay, let's go.
Pike is an Ohio county in the foothills of the Appalachian Mountains. Population 27,000, majority white. From here, there's one road into the small town of East Jackson, or EJ, as Karen calls it.
Now you're getting ready to get in EJ. And as you can see, it's country.
It is country, yeah. There's nothing but this road and trees.
It's country.
It's beautiful.
And that's one of my cousins.
We just drove past a cousin.
Yeah.
Everyone that lives there are a lot of Harrises in EJ, and they all have a complex ancestry. The people who first settled in this stretch of hills were escaped slaves fleeing the southern states. This included women who'd been raped by their masters and the children that came from those unions. The people of Pike County didn't own slaves themselves, but they certainly didn't want formerly enslaved people living in their towns, instead pushing them out to this strip of unused land. That's how Karen's ancestors ended up here. Soon, others deemed socially undesirable at the time, Native Americans and poor whites, joined them. These groups all intermarried, and East Jackson, still just 1,000 or so people strong now, is largely made up of their descendants.
But most of my cousins look like me, so. And have red hair, blue eyes.
Red hair and blue eyes.
My dad had auburn hair and green eyes.
And he still identified as black.
He was still identified as black.
Mm-hmm. And why is that?
Because that's what they said back then. Whenever you had an eighth or a 16th of that in you, you better make sure that you put it on the birth certificate. And that's what they did.
After the abolition of slavery, as some in the US sought to maintain a form of white supremacy, the one-drop rule emerged. Under this 19th century legal principle, anyone with even one black ancestor, or just a drop of so-called black blood, was considered black. And that's how the identity of this Ohio community was defined even into the late 20th century. This is why Karen and her red-headed relatives were registered black on their birth certificates.
We are proud of who we are. We're zebras. And every time I go somewhere, I honestly let them know, look, I may not look it, but I am of African descent.
And what do people say when you say that?
They're like, what? They said, no. Yeah.
What do black people say when you tell them that?
You can't be, because you're not dark enough.
Karen and her neighbours have started facing this sort of challenge in recent decades, and it angers them. They forged a community and sense of self out of something that was forced upon them. To have that questioned years later feels like a second affront.
The whites don't want to accept you because you have that ethnic of the black, and then the black don't want to accept you because you are not dark enough. So guess what? We have our own.
Karen takes me to meet Irene, her mother-in-law.
All right, Mama.
Irene is an elderly woman with lightly tanned skin wearing a nightdress.
Girl, it's dark in here.
As she speaks, she gesticulates gently with a fly swatter.
Hi.
Nice meeting
you. How are you doing?
Now, this is some of John's family right here.
Covering the walls of Irene's home are family photos.
And then here is pictures of all of us. And this is my son. that's my son, and then those are my grandsons.
The photos show a family with a patchwork of skin shades, hair textures, builds, facial structures, all of the physical signifiers which people often associate with race.
There's no color in our family.
There's no color.
Everything. My great-grandmother was a Cherokee Indian, and I think my great-grandpa, he came here from Bedford, Virginia, when they did away with slavery, but he was as dark as this.
As dark as the black microphone.
Just about.
So Irene's great-grandfather was one of those early settlers in East Jackson, fleeing the South.
Yeah, they were forced. I mean, you either stayed here or you die.
And this long history, passed down through family stories since the traumatic days of slavery, is why Karen and Irene are quick to defend the way they identify.
We never asked their granddads to mess with our grandmothers to make us the way we are. They did it. The white masters, as you call them. So no, I'm going to keep myself like I am. I'm black. Yeah.
You won't let anyone tell you anything else.
They ain't going to tell me anything else because I don't like the way that my great-grandmother was raped. They were raped by white men and made us.
This is a messed up country, I can just say that.
Outside on Irene's front porch, there are lawn jockeys, old-fashioned Americana-style statues of black men, too many to count on one hand. Here are your statues. To many people, these are racist caricatures. To others, like Irene, they're a symbol of history.
They're showing the light that slavery, you know, coming out of slavery.
The story of race and ethnicity here in the US is, and always has been, complex. It's about history, discrimination, culture, community. How much of it is the way you perceive yourself? And how much the way others perceive you? These are questions that have seeped into another presidential race, an issue still bound up in the politics of today. Simultaneously, we're told by some quarters that society needs to move beyond racial categories, but people deeply care about which category they're in. As many are encouraged to choose their identity, there are others calling out those they feel have chosen incorrectly. Though the story has evolved since Karen and Irene's ancestors first settled in East Jackson, the questions, who are you and who gets to decide, seem to matter just as much to the United States in 2024 as they always have.
I'm proud of my heritage, all of it. White, black, gray, and gray, blue.
You got that right.
Yeah.
You got that right, Mama.
Thank you for listening to this edition of Assignment, produced and presented by me, Ellie House. The sound mix was by James Beard. The production coordinator was Rosie Strawbridge, and the editor was Richard Fenton Smith.
If you're hearing this, you're probably already listening to in-depth stories on BBC Podcasts. But did you know that you can listen to them without ads? Get award-winning storytelling from the BBC, like World of Secrets, Believe in Magic and Uncanny, plus other great BBC podcasts from news to history to comedy, all ad-free. Simply subscribe to BBC Podcast Premium on Apple Podcasts or listen to Amazon Music with a Prime membership. Spend less time on ads and more time with BBC Podcasts.